Malawilele, welcome to Dateline from RNZ Pacific. I'm Ben Robinson-Drawbridge. Coming up, Papua New Guinea police target corruption and the former Prime Minister. A report finds China is not setting debt traps in the Pacific. Family problems are blamed for Fiji's missing children cases. Just two candidates contest the Tongan by-election. And an academic calls for foreign aid to fund Pacific rugby. Two arrest warrants issued in Papua New Guinea could be a sign that police are starting to make inroads on high-profile corruption. However, in the case of former Prime Minister Peter O'Neill, the matter looks destined for more court action. Johnny Blades reports.
PNG's Police Commissioner David Manning said the warrant issued for Peter O'Neill's arrest was in relation to an alleged corruption case, which he declined to give details on. Mr. O'Neill's lawyers have challenged the validity of the arrest warrant in court, claiming he would likely suffer irreparable damages caused by a defective warrant. The head of the police fraud squad, Matthew D'Amato, said the legal move was similar to when Mr. O'Neill's lawyers challenged a previous warrant for his arrest issued in 2014, in a separate corruption case. The legal action tied the matter up in court for years and the arrest warrant died a slow death.
Yeah, it's frustrating, but there's a process. People like Peter O'Neill, you know, who are suspected of committing a crime, you know, they have the right to go to court and seek redress if they feel that, you know, they have been unfairly treated.
Mr. O'Neill, who was replaced as Prime Minister in May this year, is being investigated over allegations related to the funding of churches, according to Police Minister Brian Cramer. Mr. O'Neill has characterised the case as being fabricated as a power play by Mr. Cramer and denied any wrongdoing.
For many years, as we all know, and especially you, Prime Minister, as Finance Minister, many churches and communities right throughout the country write to prime ministers, ministers directly for funding to fund their communities, particularly health and education.
Last week, Mr. O'Neill's lawyers also sent police a letter asking for clarification on the alleged charges and for more time regarding the arrest warrant. Although his directorate was not involved in the case anyway, Mr. D'Amato was one of the recipients of this letter. He says this isn't the way charges are usually relayed to someone whom police seek to arrest.
That will be done when the person is brought in for interview. That's the first thing they do in the interview process. The person cannot be informed of outside of the interview process. It's improper, you know, that's not the way it's done.
Meanwhile, PNG's Electoral Commissioner, Patalias Gamato, has been arrested and charged with corruption, money laundering and conspiracy. Police say Mr. Gamato was arrested after a probe into an electoral official found carrying over $54,000 in cash on the eve of polling in the capital during the 2017 general election. Police are investigating Mr. Gamato's claim that the money was camping allowances for election officials. The runner-up in the National Capital District seat in 2017, Andy Bawa, says the election was marred by irregularities and signs of unfairness.
At the eve of the elections, to have such a huge amount of money in cash being carried around by an election official or someone high up there became of a serious concern to most of us. And it was a concern that eventually was brought before the attention of the police.
Mr. Bawa, who's also a former Metropolitan Police Commander in the capital, says it's notable that the arrest took this long.
In my previous capacity as a Metsu, such a very high sensitive and serious allegations like that would have been dealt there and then at the time. And to have taken 2 years, I'd say it's weird.
Mr. Gamato told RNZ Pacific he wouldn't make a public comment on the case now while it's before court. Call Johnny Blades 10A.
A new report has found China is not setting debt traps in the Pacific. The research, released on Monday by Australia's Lowy Institute, contradicts much of the criticism of China's influence in the region. It found Chinese loans are not a deliberate attempt to entrap Pacific states, although they could lead to debt problems if protections aren't improved. Mackenzie Smith spoke with one of the report's authors, Roland Raja.
There's obviously a contentious debate about whether or not China's been engaged in debt trap diplomacy or not. Some people say yes, it is. Some people say no, and there's no evidence to support those sorts of concerns. And so what we're saying is that actually the evidence is mixed. So if you look backwards in time at what China's lending behavior over the last several years, you know, we would argue that it's not so problematic that you would describe that as debt trap diplomacy. But at the same time, when we look forward, we do think that China's lending behavior does pose clear risks to debt sustainability in the region, owing to the sheer size and scale of its lending, the fact that a number of Pacific countries that are already indebted to China don't really have much more space to take on more debt, and the fact that China itself lacks clear rules and policies to prevent potentially unsustainable lending. So I don't see our argument as dispelling the concerns around China's lending activities in the region. Rather, it's about bringing a more nuanced argument about what those concerns should be.
And what about countries like New Zealand and Australia? Do they pose any sort of risk as well?
You know, I don't think New Zealand engages in lending in the Pacific, and Australia is now planning to begin its own infrastructure loans to the Pacific. You know, we look at that in the report. And there is some concern that, you know, in Australia is seeking to respond to Chinese loans, that we're simply going to be making the debt sustainability situation worse in these countries. But when we look at the facility that Australia has set up, our conclusion overall is that those risks would appear to be relatively low, but for two main reasons. One is that the scale of the lending that Australia is currently targeting is actually quite small. It's about 3.6% of the region's GDP, and it's probably going to be spread out over around 10 years or so. Compare that to China, where the scale of lending is, you know, plans are something like 20% of GDP over 10 years. So the scale is much more modest. The second element is that Australia has adopted sustainable lending rules anchored to those of the IMF and the World Bank. And so that gives another level of confidence that, you know, problems can always arise, and, you know, the region is exposed to major natural disasters and other sorts of problems that you know, can always change the situation. But that does give some confidence that, you know, the scale is not that big. And then on top of that, Australia has adopted these sustainable lending rules. That gives more confidence that problems in the future can be avoided.
That was Roland Raja from Australia's Lowy Institute. Thirty-seven children are listed as missing in Fiji from about 700 that were reported missing since 2014. The Minister for National Security, Inia Seruiratu, says many of the cases are due to children running away from problems at home. Christine Ravoy reports.
In August, Fiji's parliament was told about the need for a police investigation report on the country's missing children. According to Mr. Seruiratu, the police report found that out of the 723 children missing, 686 had been found. But he says the number of children who went missing in these years is alarming.
So many reasons. Some may be because of social and economic issues at home. Some is related to some harassment or so, and of course peer pressure. And so these are the various reasons why young people are leaving their homes.
Inia Seruiratu says the government is working with the Social Welfare Ministry to address the issue. Mr. Seruiratu said out of the 37 children missing since 2014, 23 were girls and 14 were boys. Welfare officer Divinesh Kumar says he has been working with children for 5 years and recently completed a case management training course at the department.
I've learned working more effectively when dealing with cases concerning children, and the prompt response that needs to be given while the referrals comes to us, and the intervention strategies that are in place to deal with cases.
Child advocate Atedha Kalomaira has been working with young people for 15 years and says the family is the main component.
From the first step to the last, I had to include them. So important to follow all the processes and documentation.
The police report also found that out of the 150 children reported missing in 2016, 116 were girls. Miss Kalomaira says working with children in need resonates with her.
I have four children and I'm a grandmother of four. My daughter, what this has taught me is to listen to her. She's in class 7. I've had 2 marriages, and this has really taught me to listen more.
Miss Kalomaira says she needs to start with her own family at home before she can help other children.
I only hope that my daughter is well equipped, especially with regards to positive parenting. She's young, she has a young family, she has 2 children juggling with work, and I just know the scenario there with the cost of living and all that. So this is a good takeaway for me because I will share with her. We learn and share the knowledge.
The police report also found that the indigenous Itoke ethnic group dominated the number of children still missing with 26, a dramatic surge of 13 recorded so far this year. Police are continuing investigations into the missing children. Oyao Christine Ravoy, Nimodemanda.
Just 2 candidates will contest the by-election for the seat made vacant by the death of Tonga's former Prime Minister, Akilisi Pohiva. He held the Kolo Matua seat on the main island, Tongatapu, for 32 years. Mr. Pohiva's eldest son, Sia Osi, is one of the candidates. The other is the scientist, Netatua Prescott Taufatufua. Our correspondent in Tonga says Sia Osi Pohiva will fight the by-election on November the 28th using the same plank as his father, that of transparency and good governance. But Kalafi Moala told Don Wiseman Dr. Taufatufua may have an advantage by promising action on long-ignored local issues.
Of course, Dr. Neta has an advantage, and the reason being is that she is coming in with a new message, basically saying, listing all the kinds of things that she will develop for Kolo Matua, for Tongatapu number 1. You have to understand that this district is probably the most undeveloped district in the whole of Tonga. It is affected badly by flooding. The roads are some of the worst roads in Tonga. There is nothing that has been developed or shown, particularly over the last 5 years since Akilisi Pohiva became the Prime Minister. And of course, he was based here over the past 30 years. And so the message is that with all these years that he has been a representative, this district hasn't seen anything or any kind of development whatsoever.
But we have this man who had a huge reputation, who was very highly regarded to the extent that he was the top polling candidate election after election after election. So Sia Osi, he has to have an advantage there, surely.
Oh, yes. But the thing is that he is coming in basically saying the same thing that Akilisi, his father, has been saying. And his focus is on good governance. Interesting thing is the good governance message is the very thing that his father has been criticized for, is the fact that they had promised to bring in good governance, and what has been delivered over the 5 years has been so fallen short of the good governance that was promised. So he's basically saying the message is still there, the vision is still there, even though we didn't deliver. On the other hand, we have somebody that is coming in and saying that we need to prioritize the actual physical things that we need to do to lift the situation in this district.
So what sort of things is she saying?
Well, like the improvement of the roads, the improvement of the schooling facilities, education. There are 5 major schools in this area with very, very poor facilities. The improvement of things like unemployment. This district statistically heads the unemployment list in compared with any other district. The fact that the poverty issues is very rampant in this particular district. So almost everything that you have to measure, including drug dealing, for example, it's a lot of arrests, a lot of issues in this area concerning the dealing in ICE. Is something that is being reported constantly. So we are at the bottom, and I live in this area, so I can talk about this area, and it's one of the biggest constituents in Tonga, and I live right here in the very heart of this district, and we've got things very, very low, very poor situation in terms of development.
Kalafi Moala, reporting from Tonga. An academic wants the governments of New Zealand and Australia to use their foreign aid programs to fund Pacific rugby. Fijian economist Waranasi says the performances of Tonga, Samoa and Fiji at the World Cup were hindered by a lack of economic resources. Professor Nasi is joining the call for a Pacific Islands team to be included in the Super Rugby competition, which he says would encourage players to remain in the Pacific. He told Don Wiseman that funding Pacific rugby would have benefits beyond the playing field.
To be honest, having lived in Fiji all my life, you know, and as an economist, seen the impact of foreign aid in the Pacific to Fiji and the other Pacific countries, Australian aid, New Zealand aid, Chinese aid, you know, British aid, French aid, everything. And to me, it is absolutely clear that Pacific Islanders and their leaders will accept aid with open arms, but having enjoyed the benefits, will then forget all about it. And there's very little benefit for Australia and New Zealand, apart from the fact that having educated a lot of the Pacific Islanders, most of these educated Pacific Islanders end up in Australia and New Zealand anyway, right? But what does remain in the Pacific is when you look at, for instance, the sports relationships between Australia, New Zealand and the Pacific Islands. And the most prominent, of course, is the relationship is in rugby union. To me, you can take it for granted that if there was a Pacific Island rugby team, which was part of the, for instance, the Super 15 franchise, and you had home games, you know, in Samoa, Tonga and Fiji, but of course also in the New Zealand and Australian cities, you would get massive numbers of Pacific Islanders sitting together with Australians and New Zealanders enjoying a common sport.
What you would like is to turn the concept of aid that we have in the Pacific on its head somewhat and look at governments, Australia and New Zealand, putting a significant amount of that money toward a Pacific Super Rugby team because you see that as something that would meld the region more.
Oh, yes. I mean, to be honest, you look at the Australian government putting in $500 million, you know, well, I mean, the impact of that, the political impact of that, in my opinion, is negligible. But if they put in $10 million, let us say, you know, and say New Zealand put in, say, $5 million to provide the base financing of a Pacific Island Super Rugby team and let them generate the remaining finances themselves, the impact it would have on the Pacific in terms of cementing Australian and New Zealand roles in the Pacific is so profound. I believe that no other superpower would be able to displace New Zealand and Australia. And I have every confidence that, you know, an enlightened Prime Minister like Jacinta Ardern, she's got a lot of empathy, you know, for the Pacific Island people. And I think that maybe she can take the lead. And I believe that Scott Morrison, from his recent experience with the rugby league in Fiji and all that, I believe, you know, he may be amenable to a bit of influence as well. But, you know, ultimately, I think this is more than just a game. It's more than just the tourism industries, more than just the airlines in the Pacific benefiting from two-way, you know, flows of rugby fans. I believe it's a geopolitical strategic issue for Australia and New Zealand that they can bind the Pacific Islanders closer to them in a way that cannot be dislodged by superpowers with all kinds of other ulterior motives.
You could equally, of course, have China then come in and say, well, here's 20, 30, 40 million for the same process.
Well, China is already giving all kinds of stuff, you know, around the Pacific. But, you know, there is no similar people-to-people relationship with China as there is between Pacific Island people and Australia and New Zealand. You know, to me, you know, I think politicians in Australia and New Zealand have to think outside the box and not just look at what they've always been doing in the past, which is throwing aid money at the Pacific Island people. I mean, some of this other stuff, it can be a win-win situation for both Australia and New Zealand and Pacific Islanders. And I think they need to have a long vision. And I'm, of course, always thinking that there needs to be in the Pacific a Pacific community, you know, where Australia and New Zealand and the Pacific Islanders basically control a quarter of the world's globe, you know, in a very coherent way, in the same way as you have the European Union. And it would lessen many of these political tensions that arise because of superpowers coming in for their own narrow objectives.
You have been writing about the problems the Pacific faces in terms of rugby and international competition and the eligibility rules and the reasons why the national teams are not as strong as they could be. You've been doing that for 20-odd years now. Do you really think that having the governments come in and fund it substantially would be enough to turn this issue around?
Well, Well, we've had a Pacific Island team that has gone and played some of the other Super Rugby teams and beaten them, right? And, you know, the eligibility rules are only part of the problem. I think the rugby union chief, Impi, he basically put his finger and he said, look, what you have is an old colonial relationship where the good rugby players from the Pacific are welcome, you know, in Australia and New Zealand and France, but the complete team is not welcome. So you can take the raw materials, but not the finished product. And to me, it's basically applying, you know, a free market principles, WTO principles, to rugby. And if you can strengthen the rugby unions in Tonga, in Samoa, in Fiji, they will be able to keep some of their talent and they will be able to strengthen the team so that, you know, their games in the Super Rugby, their games in the World Cup, etc., are fairer. Where we can strengthen rugby union, I think we need to, even though it's an old colonial, British colonial relic, you know, in the Pacific. But nevertheless, it's a great relic. It's a great relic that the Pacific Island people really, really enjoy and they have taken to. So why not encourage that? You know, you got to play with what you got. You got to dance with the partner you got. You can't go switching around just because, you know, China would like to offer you a few millions or Russia would like to offer a few millions for some other sport.
The Fiji economist, Wadan Nasi. And that's Dateline from RNZ Pacific. You can hear these stories again on our website, rnzi.com. Toa wha.